You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll learn about a Milwaukee native who became the only American woman ever executed on the direct order of Adolf Hitler for her involvement in the Berlin resistance movement. First, trust between law enforcement and communities of color has deteriorated on the national level in the wake of several high-profile police shootings of unarmed black men in the last several years. Rebuilding the trust between police and the community was the focal point of a policing conference on Friday at UW-Platteville. Gina Barton covered the conference, and she joins us now to share the details. She's the law enforcement investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gina, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Gina, what was the goal of this conference?
The goal of this conference was to try and help community members and members of law enforcement build trust and legitimacy and learn to work better together so that some of these fatal uses of force could be avoided.
So it sounds like representatives from both groups were there. Who were the main attendees?
There were police officers there and national experts. There were also community activists and also some students studying criminal justice. So the keynote speaker was Chuck Wexler, who is the executive director of the Police Executive Research Forum in Washington, D.C., and he's extremely well known in terms of coming up with progressive ways to help police do a better job in serving their community.
And you wrote in your piece that some starting points for conversation included better police training and building personal relationships and also acknowledging that race and ethnicity can impact an officer's actions. So starting with improving police training, what did you hear about that?
Well, one of the new ideas in police training is de-escalation, which basically means instead of using force, that when a police officer is called to a tense scene, they should try to calm everybody down. And so one of the suggestions is that that is adopted as agency policy. And another new tactic that they were discussing is using fatal force kind of as a last resort, which is sort of the philosophy now, but it's not necessarily written into people's policies. And some people seem to think that the police officers could use better training in terms of coming up with alternatives to fatal force and gunfire specifically.
And those examples of improved police training you were talking about, would those represent a pretty significant shift in the way police are trained now?
Well, I think that both of these ideas are just starting to come to the forefront of police training in recent years. And hopefully the people at the conference were all very optimistic that they would gain greater legitimacy and be used more often.
We're talking with Gina Barton right now. She is the law enforcement investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And we're talking about the 21st Century Policing Conference that was held at UW-Platteville on Friday. And Gina, another one of those talking points was an emphasis on building personal relationships. How did that conversation unfold?
Well, one of my favorite speakers at this conference was a sergeant from the police department in Darlington, Wisconsin. And that's a small community in southwest Wisconsin. And about 15 years ago, they had a large influx of Mexican nationals and Latino people when a company called Mexican Cheese Producers came in. And this was a controversy, first of all, because it was not a diverse community at the time, and second of all, because a lot of the people who came in were not in the country legally. And so the police department there, instead of focusing on whether the new residents of the community were legal or illegal, illegally in the country, said, hey, we're going to have an open-door policy, we're going to build relationships with people. And so this particular police sergeant had an open door policy and did everything from helping Spanish speakers to schedule their oil changes to bringing in an attorney to do a seminar to help people gain legal residency. And so by building those relationships and building that trust, he then was able to solve several crimes, including two murders and a multi-state prostitution ring.
So it sounds like in that case, the police department really also became a resource for the community and was really embedded in the fabric.
Yes, they definitely did. And I think that a lot of police agencies talk about how building relationships and building trust in the community and community policing is important for reducing crime. But I think this particular community really is a good example for what concrete steps departments can take to do that.
And then lastly, I want to talk about another major talking point at this conference, which was acknowledging that race and ethnicity can impact an officer's actions. And I guess part of this is recognizing that there is such a thing as bias, but if you are trained, you can recognize it and you can work to avoid it. So what did you hear about that conversation point?
Right. And I mean, one of the community activists who spoke on a panel in particular was very, very emphatic about the idea that people need to start talking about racism, because if communities don't have those conversations with those police departments and everybody pretends race is not an issue, that doesn't help any problems get solved. That doesn't help misunderstandings get solved. And so one of the main speakers talked about implicit bias, which is basically that people's own upbringing and life experiences are going to lead them to feel certain ways about certain groups of people, even though they might not consciously know that. And so there are all kinds of exercises that people can do and questionnaires that they can fill out that they use with police officers to help them realize, oh boy, you know, I do feel this way about a certain group and I didn't even know it. And then once they recognize that bias, they can work to stop having the bias and also to not let that bias affect the way they do their job.
And I liked one of the quotes that you had in your piece. One of the officers there said, you know, I might not be able to change how someone has grown up for the past 20 years, but I can change how they live for the next 20 or 30 years in the future.
Right. That was Dr. Mark Bowman, who is the director for the Center for Excellence in Justice Administration in North Carolina. And he is the one who has done a lot of study about this implicit bias and, you know, found that if police officers learn to recognize those biases and if they get the training, then they become less likely to use deadly force.
Now, there was a representative, at least one that you wrote about, from Young, Gifted, and Black, Brandi Grayson, and she shared some words with the attendees there. What did she say?
Right, and she was the woman I was referencing earlier who said, you know, we really need to acknowledge that racism exists in Wisconsin and among police officers. And she believes that the community should have some control over policing, over who's hired and what the rules are for police officers and how they act. There was another community activist there, Amelia Roycomore, who agreed with a lot of her ideas. And the two of them were saying, unless the community has meaningful input into the way policing is done and also into the way police officers are held accountable when they do use fatal force, that trust is never going to be built.
And Gina, going forward, were there takeaways from this conference that were going to be acted upon soon in the police departments who were attending?
Well, I think one major thing is that there were a lot of criminal justice students there. And so I think one major point of this conference was to take these people who will soon enter the criminal justice field and kind of help them be thinking about these concepts and bringing them to whatever departments they enter when they start their careers. But then also, I think the conversations are definitely going to continue about how to build trust, how to build legitimacy, how to improve these relationships. And I think, you know, getting to meet people like that sergeant from Darlington could really be instructive for police officers in places like Milwaukee, where they're still trying to build trust between the African-American community and the police department.
Gina, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Gina Barton, law enforcement investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And she was with us there talking about the 21st Century Policing Conference held at UW-Platteville on Friday. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, national polls show a lack of support for major party presidential candidates from younger voters. We'll talk to an expert and try to find out why. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Mildred Fish Harnack was the only American woman executed by Hitler during World War II. Writer Meg Jones tells us about the Milwaukee-born literature teacher turned spy.
Mildred Harnack spent her last hours reading Walt Whitman. She knew exactly where and when and how she was going to die. I wonder what she was thinking in those last moments before she was beheaded at a prison near Berlin. All that's known of her final thoughts were the last words she spoke to a chaplain. She told him right before the guillotine blade fell, "And I have loved Germany so much." Mildred Harnack is a World War II hero who didn't earn any medals and whose name seemed to be lost to history until recently. She was the only civilian American woman executed on direct orders of Adolf Hitler. She grew up in Milwaukee and earned a degree at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where she met a German exchange student named Arvid Harnack. They got married at Picnic Point on Lake Mendota and moved to Germany in 1929. Mildred and Arvid were communists at a time when communism was not yet considered evil. It was the 1930s, and much of the world was mired in the Great Depression. Arvid was an economist in Germany's government. Mildred taught English literature and translated English language books into German. When Hitler and the Nazi Party rose to power, Mildred and Arvid became alarmed and began to pass government secrets to the Soviet Union. They became part of what the Nazis called the Red Orchestra, a code name for the anti-Nazi resistance movement in Germany. Mildred translated Franklin Roosevelt's speeches into German, as well as news from America, which was printed in leaflets quietly distributed as a way to bypass the Nazi-controlled press. I think the saddest part of Mildred's fate is that all of the secrets passed to the Soviets fell in deaf ears. The Red Orchestra told Stalin that Germany would invade the Soviet Union, but Stalin didn't believe it. And it was the incompetence of their Soviet spy handlers that led to the capture of Mildred, Arvid, and their friends. They rounded up in the fall of 1942, and almost all were sentenced to die, except Mildred. Initially, she was sentenced to 5 years in prison because judges believed her lawyer's argument that she was merely a German Hausfrau following her husband's orders. But Hitler intervened and ordered her to be retried with only one outcome: execution. Arvid was slowly strangled on a meat hook. 2 months later, it was Mildred's turn to die. This is going to sound strange, but the Nazis actually considered it a favor to Mildred to kill her by guillotine because it was a quick death. After the war, the Red Orchestra became a silent footnote to history. Even though the Soviets were America's allies during World War II, they quickly became enemies as an Iron Curtain dropped across Europe. Instead of being hailed as patriots who tried to stop Hitler and end the war, Mildred, Arvid, and the rest of the Red Orchestra were considered traitors because they were communists. In the last decade or so, however, that's changed. And Mildred Harnack has been featured in books and documentaries. And in Wisconsin schools, September 16th is celebrated as Mildred Harnack Day. It's her birthday.
Meg Jones is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the author of World War II Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Joining us now to tell us more about the life of Mildred Fish Harnack is Arthur Heitzer, president of the Milwaukee Turners. 30 years ago, his efforts helped convince our state to designate September 16th as Mildred Fish Harnack Day. Arthur, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Do you think that after all this time, we fully appreciate and understand the legacy and the story of Mildred Fish Harnack and her husband Arvid?
No, I know that because we just had doors open in Milwaukee, and we were leading tours of in Turner Hall, where there's a picture and plaque for her, and we asked how many people have ever heard of Mildred Fish Harnack, and pretty much nobody. So, and the idea that it's really being taught and noted in the schools, which the state law requires on September 16th, which I guess was last Friday, does not seem to be strictly observed, I guess I would put it that way. So, I mean, it's an amazing story, but it's somewhat but not very well known in the state or in this country, for that matter.
And you played a part in getting Wisconsin to observe September 16th, last Friday, as Mildred Fish Harnack Day. What did you tell the people who are making that decision about why this day mattered?
Well, the particular timing of that was that President Reagan had decided to go to a cemetery, Bitburg in Germany, and lay wreaths where SS soldiers were buried. And a lot of people were very upset by that in this country and state and around the world, for that matter. So we felt that this was a good and appropriate time for at least the state to honor the only American who was executed for being part of the German resistance, Dettler. And, you know, she was not German. She was not Jewish. She was of English stock. When she died, her last words were, "And I love Germany so much." But she was an internationalist and a patriot in the highest sense, and an extremely accomplished scholar. She was a pioneer in having people in Europe recognize American literature as its own field, and taught and translated, etc., and used her skills and gave her life to defeat the Nazis.
I understand she had a close friend who had high connections in this country, in Washington, so she was able to, sort of on the sly, obtain some visas for people that she was trying to help. How did that work, and why did that connection not serve her when she was trying to avoid execution?
Well, one of the elements of her courage and dedication is that under the Third Reich, she did visit the U.S., and her husband, who was German-born, and she was Milwaukee-born, wanted her to stay here and be safe, but she was dedicated to go back and finish the process. So she went back to Germany. You know, at the time that she was executed, I think, among other things, Hitler was looking to make an example of the U.S. For our involvement in the war, and this was the only civilian that he had in his hands from the U.S. So I don't think we had any big leverage in doing anything here. She was a close confidant of the U.S. embassy and stationed there to the degree it continued to exist. Martha Dodd was the daughter of the U.S. ambassador. If people are familiar with the book In the Garden of the Beasts, by Eric Larson, was a bestseller about 3 years ago, and that talked about the Dodd family, and Mildred's mentioned many times. So she was an intimate with that. Donald Heath, who was in charge after the ambassadorial level was ended, was very close to Arvid and Mildred as well, and I had close contact with some of Donald Heath's children, who were extremely moved and touched by Mildred's presence and by her loss.
When did you first get involved in the story and learn about her, and not just learn about her, but feel a personal connection that drove you to action?
Well, I got out of law school in 75, and it was not long after that. And there was a publication that originated in East Germany, actually, that was republished here in the U.S. About Mildred from Milwaukee, and it said that her story should be known and honored in the U.S., and I certainly agreed with that sentiment, having learned about her for the first time. And then, you know, she had a sister then living in Wauwatosa, and she had a niece who had lived with her, who was living in Chevy Chase, Maryland, who I interviewed at some length. I tried to preserve some of the record that was still available here, and then looked at the UW archives, and basically tried to get people to know something about her. Because, as I think your intro mentioned, she and her husband Arvid were honored in the East. There was a postage stamp in their honor, for example, and we felt that as the only American who gave her life as part of the German resistance, that people in the U.S. should know about her and honor her as well.
You mentioned that you felt that the teaching of her life story was only maybe honored sort of loosely here in Wisconsin and maybe in the Milwaukee area. What would you say to encourage educators listening right now to include her in the curriculum?
Well, we have so many issues today, issues of cross-cultural identity and challenges, issues of immigration, etc. Mildred was, a heroine in every sense of the word. She was an internationalist. You know, one of the things she did with her linguistic skills in Germany during the Second World War, when countries were occupied, the German guys were all busy fighting, so they would bring in occupied people from France, Poland, Czech Republic, other countries to work in the munitions factory. So they had resistance group with the Harnacks and others had circulated newspapers in about 5 different languages urging these people to resist and not to give wholehearted loyalty to building these munitions. So those issues of, should we fear the other people from other countries are threats to us, etc. Those are live issues. The idea that someone could be a first-rate academic person and still act courageously is something that probably is a challenge that might inspire people who are learned and dedicated to know that they can also act outside of the ivory tower.
Arthur, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about her today.
Thank you for inviting me.
That was Arthur Heitzer, president of the Milwaukee Turners, and we've been talking about the life of Mildred Fish Harnack. Coming up, we'll talk about why younger voters don't seem to be supporting major party candidates and looking at how that might play out on Election Day. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Reveal. Tonight, a look back at the Phoenix VA scandal that led to changes in veterans' health care, then how veterans' choice legislation turned Alaska's homegrown health care system upside down, leaving some VA hospitals strangled with red tape. That's coming up tonight at 7 on Reveal. First, there are only 49 days until the presidential election this November. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and Republican candidate Donald Trump have vastly different takes on many of the big issues in this election year, including the economy, national security, and education. But the candidates do have one thing in common. They struggle to attract younger voters. Last week, two major polls found that more than a third of voters under the age of 30 are planning to vote for one of the third-party candidates, either Gary Johnson of the Libertarian Party or Jill Stein of the Green Party. In a Quinnipiac University poll released last week, only 31% of voters under 35 supported Clinton in a four-way race, and 3 in 5 young voters have a, quote, strongly unfavorable view of Donald Trump. Constance Flanagan joins us now to talk about why young voters aren't supporting the major party candidates in this election. She's a professor of human ecology and associate dean of the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. Connie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Why aren't young people getting behind the major party candidates this year?
Well, it may be early, so I don't think we should jump to conclusions. A lot of people are still making up their minds. I think in part, if you contrast the current election with the candidates that the millennials did get behind at this time around Bernie Sanders in the primary and behind Barack Obama in 2008, there was a kind of aspirational quality to both of those campaigns, some sort of sense of, a clear contrast in the way things are and the sort of hope about what could be. So both, I think, Sanders made it clear that the inequality was the clear thing on the agenda, and linking the what millennials face themselves in terms of things like college debt or low-wage work. So the $15 an hour campaign and the issue of college debt, and linking that to the broader issue of inequality was pretty effective. And then there was an alternative. It was sort of like, we can make a different kind of America. So that was appealing. I don't see that they're completely turned off. I think it's a matter now for the candidates to make it clear why millennials and their future is linked to the policies that the candidates are proposing. And I think young people will listen.
You said it's maybe too early to be making that claim that millennials aren't on board with either Trump or Clinton, but there's only 49 days left. Doesn't it seem like we're in the home stretch now and that what we're seeing now looks kind of unusual?
Well, but young people are so facile at making decisions. I mean, they're a mobile group. They can register online in, I think, over 30 states now. So a lot can still happen. And I know Hillary Clinton is sending out a lot of surrogates to, things like tailgates and places where young people would be to, and Bernie Sanders is going out, and Elizabeth Warren, so, and President Obama. So I think there's an appeal going out from at least that camp, that campaign, to say why it's in their interest to, make it clear. The other thing that often happens when it's your first time to vote is, like, there's an ideal possible world that you sort of imagine. And so the fact that politics is about compromise and accommodation may not seem that attractive. But I think when the millennials begin to connect what kind of world they want and what they believe in to what the two platforms stand for, we're going to see a lot more come over.
Now, you're saying when they begin to connect that world with the world they live in, I mean, how does that happen? Because so far it hasn't happened, and we've had two conventions, Republican and Democratic. We've had campaigning. So what's in the secret sauce that millennials suddenly realize there is something in these candidates?
Well, as the election gets closer, it will become more and more a question of conversation. I think the fact that there are rallies happening in the places where they are will cause people to talk more about the issues. And normative pressure from peers is a huge reason why people register and vote. So as soon as you have friends that are talking about it and saying it's important, that catches on. So I'm actually more optimistic than the current polls suggest.
We're talking to Constance Flanagan right now from UW-Madison about why it seems that young voters are hesitant, they're reluctant to throw in behind either of the major presidential candidates this year from either party. And we're taking your calls on this at 800-642-1234. Why do you think it seems that younger voters aren't getting behind the major party candidates this presidential election season? And do you agree with our guest? Do you agree with Constance Flanagan that they will fall in line between one party or the other? It just has to pick up a little momentum, and they have to tie some of their ideals to the real world struggles and decide who they align with. Do you think that's going to happen? Or do you think there's something different about these candidates and this year? If you're a young person, if you're a millennial, how are you feeling right now? Call 800-642-1234. And Constance, we were talking about how both Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are going to be out on the stump for Hillary Clinton, trying to galvanize these young voters, these millennials, and get them excited. So what is the Donald Trump equivalent of that? Does he have a move that will maybe accomplish the same thing?
I don't know actually what the possible appeal is, and I'm actually not familiar with what it is that his campaign's doing specifically for young voters. So I actually don't know what the strategies are there in the campaign. The one issue that the millennial generation is more diverse demographically than any generation has been, and they're also much more tolerant. So the kinds of things they stand for sort of are not a great match for the kinds of things he has stood for. So I don't know how much he's reaching out to the youth vote.
And do you think it matters to him?
Well, winning matters, I suppose, to anybody. And at least what I've read, the millennials represent a potential one-third of the electorate if they come out. That's as big as the baby boom. And we know the baby boom will come out. So they have huge potential. There's some analyses of the 2012 youth vote that suggests that it was young people who swung the elections in places like Ohio, Florida, Virginia, so in the presidential race. So their vote matters in terms of who wins. So it makes sense for the candidates to reach out for them. I'm just not sure whether the messages of the Trump campaign are a good match for the kinds of things that, in general, the millennials are standing for, keeping in mind they are a very diverse group. So, you know, we're generalizing for a whole generation, and there's a lot of variability within that group.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Mike joining us from Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. I don't understand the Clinton organization, why they didn't give Bernie Sanders either the vice presidential running position or concretely extend to him perhaps Secretary of State, because he was probably garnering 7 out of 10 out of the youth who are the dynamic part of any campaign. And even presently, I think this youth is trying to figure out who they really want to go for. I just can't understand why. It seems to me like Clinton picked a similar running mate as what the Alaska governor, Sarah Palin, amounted to for, I guess, 10 years ago that was now. But anyway, it just didn't seem like it was a good dynamic pick in order to pull the youth vote in. And when I ask people what they think about Hillary's running mate, Mike Pence, most people don't realize that I'm actually not telling them the right name. They can't tell me who her running mate even is.
Mike, thanks for that. And what do you make of all the arguments that Mike has there? He's wondering, first and foremost, why the Clinton campaign didn't bring Bernie Sanders on board in a strong way as a VP pick or an offer for Secretary of State, because he would have brought that youth vote.
Well, it's hard to say what goes on behind the scenes. You know, none of us are really privy to that. At least in the convention, what all of us watched, you know, on the convention, it seemed like Bernie Sanders and his campaign felt like in the platform they got a lot of what they wanted to happen. And so there was a commitment on the part of, you know, the Clinton team that the 15 minimum wage, et cetera, were things that they stood for. I have no idea what are the bases for, you know, for how these picks happen. That said, I mean, it is the case that people like Elizabeth Warren or even President Obama are out there stumping for her now. So, I mean, and I understand what President Obama is saying, particularly the young people, is that there's the worry that a lot that was accomplished in his 8 years, you know, could go backwards, and that people should start standing up and being worried about that. So, I do think that, I mean, young people get excited about dynamism and change and the plodding nature of being a policy wonk and, you know, compromising is not as exciting in terms of a first campaign to get involved in, but that's the way the politics works.
We're talking to Connie Flanagan right now from the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison, talking about why young voters are struggling with major party presidential candidates. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Why do you think younger voters aren't getting behind the major party candidates in this cycle? And if you are one of these younger voters, if you're a millennial, who are you supporting and why? Or are you undecided and you're waiting for something to click? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll be back with this conversation after a short break here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our discussion now with Connie Flanagan from the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. And we're talking about young voters and their seeming reluctance to support either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton in this election. And we're taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. What do you think would help to engage young voters in this election cycle? And why do you think millennial voters aren't really into either major party candidate right now? If you're a younger voter, have you picked somebody? And if not, what are you waiting for? Call 800-642-1234. And you can also post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take a caller now. We've got Mark with us in Delavan. Mark, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, you two. I disagree with your guest. I don't think that that all the millennials, I mean, I'm sure she wouldn't say all the millennials, but I think a significant portion of them will not come around, especially college kids. I think there's been a lot of discussion of the issues, the differences between Sanders and Clinton. For example, Clinton is still very close to the banks and has not released the transcripts of her her talks to the banks. There's also the issue of she's very much of a war hawk, and a lot of us are very, myself and some younger voters, are very not happy with President Obama's wars. And a lot of us feel that they're unnecessary, that we're creating.
And Mark, do you project that millennials then will stay home?
That is a great question. So many of all of us, including millennials, are told that their vote for a third party candidate, for example, Jill Stein, would be wasted, and that would be a vote for Trump. And other people make other arguments, saying that we can't keep just voting for the lesser evil. So where is each individual student going to come down on that? Do they believe that there's a good reason to vote for a third-party candidate, or do they just say it doesn't matter and stay home?
Mark, thanks a lot for your thoughts there. And Mark's saying he doesn't really think people are going to come around, young voters are going to come around, if they have these fundamental, foundational differences with either candidate. He's talking in this case about Hillary Clinton. So what do you think about that question? Do you think these young voters will stay home on election day?
Well, I think he makes a good point. I mean, apparently there's a lot of young people are interested in the Libertarian Party because, in part, of their non-interventionist foreign policy. So I think he's making a good point. And it is true that whenever we face an election, it's our principles and our values and whether the candidates live up to them. And that may be a more important thing for first-time voters, so that sacrificing principle and accommodating is just something that ethically people have a hard time doing. That said, I mean, some of us lived through the third-party candidate of Ralph Nader, and so something about aging perhaps makes you more accommodating to the practice as opposed to the principle of what is the alternative. So we can live with principles, and I happen to think that's a really important thing to do, but there are consequences in practice if large numbers of people decide either to go with a third party for a presidential or to stay home.
And I want to get in one more quick call. Sam in Madison is next. Sam, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to comment and say that I am a millennial and I previously voted for Jill Stein back in 2008. But I am personally supporting Hillary Clinton this year because I feel like with some of the third party platforms and absolutely in the Trump campaign, they are more bullheading their politics instead of meeting in a moderate middle. And Clinton has a record of working with people, regardless of how you feel about what she's worked on.
Sam, thanks a lot for calling. And Sam seems to have decided she'd voted for Jill Stein in the past. Now she is supporting Hillary Clinton as a millennial. And Connie, as we wrap up, you said you think that some of these younger voters will decide. What are you watching for in the next several weeks to indicate which direction the wind is blowing? And just briefly, please.
Well, I'll definitely pay attention to what the polling says, but I also have my ear to what's going on a campus, although a large number of millennials are not on campuses, and so we have to remember that. So I'll keep my ear to the conversations that are going on around the young people around me.
Connie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Constance Flanagan, professor of human ecology and Associate Dean of the School of Human Ecology at UW-Madison. And she joined us there talking about why young voters seem to be struggling to support major party candidates in this presidential election. Some people who want to add solar panels to their homes or businesses are leery of the costs, and some have found a solution. Dozens of people are joining together and getting a discount from the installer. A just-completed group buy of solar power in the Milwaukee area may have been the state's largest. Chuck Kornbach reports.
At the home of Quentin Bendixson and Jamie Fershinger in Milwaukee's Bayview neighborhood, there are 6 solar panels on the roof, generating nearly 2 kilowatts. A relatively tiny amount, but more than enough power for this 1,100-square-foot home to run appliances, lights, this kitchen radio. The solar panels, a meter, and other equipment here are only 2 months old, as this summer Bendixson and Fershinger signed up for a group buy of solar power, organized by the Midwest Renewable Energy Association, the City of Milwaukee, and Village of Shorewood. Bendixson says the roughly 20% savings from guaranteeing a contractor a large amount of work finally helped make solar a go.
They've been doing the group buy for a couple of years now, and I've gone to every year, I've gone to every session, and I run the numbers because I want to do it, but it also has to make sense. And this is the first year that I felt like it really made sense.
Jamie Fershinger says it also helped that the City of Milwaukee is backing the group buy and emphasized that any neighborhood could take part.
It shows that it's a priority to the city, and it starts the conversation in the community.
But Fershinger and Bendixson quickly add that the falling prices of solar panels and the panels' greater efficiency also were key factors. Their house is still on the grid, meaning electricity and natural gas from local utility We Energies will still be used, but the couple hopes the payback on their solar investment will be 8 years or less. The Midwest Renewable Energy Association reports that about 50 people have signed up for the group buy that ended last Friday, including some business owners. Airplanes seem to sound louder and fly lower when you're on the roof of a 5-story apartment building. This is the newly renovated Sage on Prospect complex, which has 96 solar panels providing electricity to about 30 tenants. Mike O'Connor is co-owner of the building. He says the way that he's plugged utility charges into the rent, the cheaper to operate solar will pay off for him.
And that's really the concept that I think is the most powerful one, is that if I can get across to other landlords and other developers out there that they can make money by being green, then I think that they'll probably be interested in doing that.
O'Connor has not only added solar panels on the apartment building, he's also joined the group buy to put solar on his home in the suburbs. Elizabeth Hittman coordinates sustainability programs for the City of Milwaukee, and for group buys has helped streamline the permit process. Hittman says while she's trying to spread group solar across the area, it's not for everyone.
If you have too much shading on your roof, or, you know, if you're renting a home and your landlord isn't interested, that, you know, it wouldn't really be an option for you.
And Hittman says at $5,000 to $7,000 for a typical residential project that's after tax credits, some homeowners can't afford solar just yet. Electric utilities say the mini surge in solar homes has forced them to raise fixed rates on utility bills because most solar users still need electric wires and other infrastructure. But Peter Murphy of the Midwest Renewable Energy Association says MREA plans to coordinate more group buys because people want more control over their power supply.
Democratization, decentralization. When you own your own solar panels, you're basically your own little power plant.
Or plants if you team up with others on a group solar purchase. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.